Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Rem Ryder's career in journalism spans decades. In 1991, he became editor at the American Journalism Review. He's also worked at the Washington Post, the Miami Herald, and the Milwaukee Journal. Much of his career has been devoted to watching the watchdogs, that is, evaluating and scrutinizing the media. In 2013, he was recruited by USA Today to write a media column and as editor at large. We caught up with Rem Ryder in Sioux Falls after he spoke to the Sioux Falls Downtown Rotary. I started by asking him about the changing nature of American journalism.
Just talk about the change, you just have to start with the digital revolution. That's kind of changed everything. It's hard to imagine, but when I started at AJR, it was before the digital revolution had blown up journalism as we knew it in good and bad ways. There's only one cable network at the time. It was just a very, very, very different world, and it's been fascinating to watch all these changes. I mean, there's so many. The digital world has just made for so much more journalism, and so firstly, we take it for granted now, but it's given readers access to so much more. We have all these wonderful new forms. At the same time, the pressure on traditional journalism has really been very tough. I mean, there's been a tremendous loss of newspaper jobs, and often at the local, the local level. And that, that really weakens a community supply of news. And we've had exciting things come up in the digital world, but the local level, often they're kind of small. They're more complementary. There aren't a lot of new local institutions digitally that have anywhere near the size of the reporting staff that even a small local newspaper would have. So while there's a lot to admire, there's still a lot to be made up for.
Is there a cumulative effect to that as far as the quality of the journalism that's in our communities and in the national coverage as well?
Yeah, I think there is. In the national level, there have been more new important players that have to some extent made up for that, although still a big shortfall. When I was at AJR, we used to do thanks to a couple of grants we had, we used to do a census, among other things, of all the people covering government agencies.
Mm-hmm.
Not just covering the White House or the big flap of the day, but the agencies where a lot of the real business gets done that affects people. And those numbers drop precipitously over time. And similarly, at the local level, no matter how hard people are working, you have fewer people, which, means beats uncovered. It means less time that people can devote to big, ambitious projects that are so important. One of the things that's always driven me crazy is the publisher announces a round of cutbacks and says, "But don't worry, we're going to do more with less." No, you're not. You're going to do less with less.
Yeah. Is there any way that news consumers can have an impact on that industry at all, other than just, subscribing to your local newspaper? Are there things that the regular person who wants quality coverage can contribute, or is it just this is the way the industry is going, and the rest of us are along for the ride?
Well, again, it's an industry in transition, so we're not. I mean, hopefully, at some point, someone will figure out an economic model where digital journalism is more easily sustainable, and hopefully in a different form, we'll have those larger staffs again. And it's interesting, you asked about citizens. One of the, we've talked about the rise of citizen journalism, where in the age of social media, you have, if there's an earthquake somewhere, there's instantly on Twitter there are pictures and descriptions, and so citizens, in a different way can contribute to the public's understanding of a story. It's no replacement for the journalist sifting it all together, and there's the whole problem of unverified information and phony Twitter accounts. But one of the exciting things is that citizens can participate. And with blogs, it can allow more voices in the conversation. When Dan Rather got in trouble years back with a flawed story on George W. Bush's military service, That program was done in by, in part by blogs, something that would have been unimaginable. It really changed the digital age, changed the role of my journalism review enormously. I mean, in innocent times, you know, you'd wait till a monthly magazine, and your cover story would be the definitive account of the latest journalism disaster, and now it would seem like news from the prehistoric age, as things play out so much more quickly.
Let's dig into citizen journalism a little bit. I think a lot of folks in South Dakota, North Dakota, our region, are watching Dakota Access Pipeline protests largely on Facebook. I don't know if that's something that you've been following at all. And what is some of the stuff that you see coming out of there, and how does it impact how we sort of interact with this story of what's happening in Standing Rock and Cannonball, North Dakota?
Well, it's one of that kind of journalism, and the advent of citizen participation, and the advent of social media, you know, really, really can help fill in holes. Again, help. It's not a panacea by any means, but it's a way that in a primitive time, pre Facebook and Twitter, you wouldn't necessarily have access to those voices and those points of view, and so a story. You know, if traditional media weren't covering a story, it's almost like the old thing about the tree falling in the forest and nobody hearing it. And now, you know, there is an outlet, for citizens to be heard and for previously ignored events not to be ignored.
But there are little to no journalistic standards from citizens. I mean, when I studied journalism, there were certain things that you learn in basic journalism 101 that you don't see happening in some of those Facebook posts. What's the risk of that?
Well, there's quite a risk. That's what I was saying before. It's not a substitute for journalism. I mean, it can be a real tool for journalism. It's like access to a lot of firsthand voices, that kind of thing. But it really, your question is a great one, because it really does underscore the need for journalists to separate fact from fiction, truth from rumor, to make sure something isn't being overly swayed by a point of view. So it's a valuable part of the equation, but it's not the whole equation.
Let's talk about, you mentioned journalism failures, some of the big ones, and let's shift to the election, the 2016 presidential election. Give me some ideas of where we've gone wrong in the industry with the coverage from the debates.
There's an election going on?
There is.
I'm glad to hear about that.
Somewhat significant one.
Somebody else had mentioned that to me. It's been a very difficult election to cover, because Donald Trump is just unlike anybody else we've seen and certainly in my memory as a major party presidential candidate. He doesn't have a background in politics. He's a businessman and a reality TV guy. He doesn't play by the rules. He's very at times can be very clever at manipulating the media, and I think there was for a while quite a bit of confusion about what to do about him. I think there were news outlets that took too long to take him seriously, and understandably, because he had no background. You know, he flirted with running before and then didn't. So it was a question of how serious a candidate is he, and does he? And the sense early on, he doesn't have a chance. After all, he was one of 17 candidates, and a lot of those candidates, had pretty substantial track records. And so, I think there with a tendency not to take him seriously, there was maybe a failure to do some of the hard reporting that came later about his record. There was also a tendency, because his rallies, and it's very good, it's very good TV, then if you like that sort of thing, and so he got huge amounts of free airtime on cable, and it was all uncritical. They'd kind of let the camera go at his rallies, and so it really worked to his advantage. I think it was a big factor in getting his name out there and in his victory in the primaries. But, you know, the confusion, here's how difficult it was. The Huffington Post at some point said that we're not going to cover him in the news pages. We're going to cover him on the entertainment page mm-hmm. of the Huffington Post, which I thought was ludicrous. I mean, you don't. What's the old Rumsfeld line about you go to war with the army you have, not the one you want? Mm. I mean, you cover the campaign you have before you, and even if he's a reality TV guy and you don't think much of him, you don't get to decide as a journalist who gets covered and who doesn't. Mm.
So a misguided attempt to sort of manipulate in return or make a stand. What was their goal there?
Well, their goal, in the case of the Huffington Post, their goal is to make him go away and belittle him. In general, though, I think that avalanche of cable and television coverage was really unfortunate. There's a terrible quote from Les Moonves, who runs CBS. He said, "Donald Trump may be bad for democracy, but he's been very good for CBS." Hmm. There's an uplifting journalist and battle cry if I've ever heard one.
Hmm.
And certainly CNN has had a really profitable year, and a lot of it was from that extensive coverage of Trump. Now, as time has gone on, and the media has done a lot of really good work on this campaign, and interesting, some of the best work has come from the much maligned traditional media. You know, we talk about how the new digital forces are in command, and mm-hmm. The lessening of the impact of traditional media, but it was the New York Times who broke the story that Hillary Clinton had exclusively used a private email server while Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. It was the New York Times that broke the story on Trump's tax return and that colossal loss. And David Farenthold of the Washington Post has broken story after story on the Trump Foundation and Trump's giving or lack thereof. And it was this same reporter who got and verified the Access Hollywood tape in which Trump made those awful comments. There's also been a lot of good reporting, and some by my alma mater, USA Today, the USA Today Network, and as well as many other organizations on Trump's business practices,
mm-hmm.
and on Clinton's on the email story and on the foundation. You know, I think as time has gone on, our better journalist institutions have found their footing and have done the due diligence that needed to be done. I think there'll be a lot of looking back when this is over and trying to figure out, how do we... You remember the Republicans, after they lost the last election, had that autopsy to try to figure out mm-hmm. how they could do better, and mm-hmm. then Trump came along and threw it out the window. But I think the journalistic world will do a lot of that.
And where do they start as sort of the post-mortem on that, the day after the election? What do they do to look back and say, why did it take us so long to find our
footing? Exactly. I think they look back at the primary time at the earlier stages of Trump's entrance into the campaign and in those early months and try to assess, what in the future how you would approach something like that.
After the break, more with media columnist Rem Ryder. We'll talk about the relationship between Donald Trump and the press corps, and we'll look into Hillary Clinton's avoidance of the media. You're listening to Dakota Midday, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Let's get back to our conversation with former USA Today media columnist Rem Ryder. Ryder has spent decades monitoring journalistic integrity, changes in the industry, and a free press. Here we talk about this year's presidential candidates and their relationship to the First Amendment. I want to talk about Hillary Clinton, but let's stay on Donald Trump for a minute, because I don't know that there's been a candidate who's had such an interesting take on the First Amendment and his relationship with the media itself. Do you want to talk a little bit about how not only does he manipulate the media, but how he even handles them at a rally, for example? That's new, isn't it?
It's very new. It's a great question. And it's the first time I can remember that somebody has run against the media so aggressively as a major part of his or her campaign. I mean, but we've been hearing for months from Trump that the election is rigged, against him. And part of the way it's rigged against him is the corrupt media. Hmm. And so, you know, day after day, that's been his theme. And yes, at his rallies, he does something that's kind of scary. He singles out individual journalists who were there and calls them names and fires up the crowd against them. And he's banned news organizations from, if they write something he doesn't like, from covering his rallies. And he said that if he's elected, or when he's elected, maybe, he said he wants to change libel laws to make it easier to sue the news media, all of which, you know, bespeaks a kind of contempt for something that's really important in our democracy. I mean, one of the cornerstones is a free press, an unfettered press that in its imperfect way serves as a watchdog on government. And he seems to completely reject that. I mean, he seems to think the idea is to, if he likes you, if you write nice stories about him, and otherwise he doesn't. And that he didn't invent that. I mean, that's true of politicians as long as they've been politicians. But as is so often the case with Donald Trump, he's taken it up a couple of notches.
Does he have a point in any of the criticisms that he's sort of levied against certain news organizations? Has he pointed out anything that they should consider and say be more thoughtful in their coverage? Or is it complete inflammatory anti-First Amendment rhetoric?
I think it's largely that. I mean, many of the stories that have upset him are legitimate stories. I mean, there's a wonderful slogan that the Aspen Daily News has, and it says, if you don't want to read about it, don't let it happen. And in his case, you know, this is a man who attacked John McCain, attacked Fox News' Megyn Kelly in an unbelievable way for a presidential candidate, who's attacked a Gold Star mother and father, who's proposed bans on all Muslims entering the United States, attacked Mexicans coming to this country as criminals and rapists, and on and on. And plus the comments that the hot mic picked up on the Access Hollywood, where he said things about women that would be stunning coming from anybody, but coming from a major party's presidential candidate. And not only does he do this, he can't let go of anything. So he takes a one-day story and turns it into a five-day story by still relitigating it. And 5 days after the debate, he's still attacking the former beauty pageant winner as being too fat. And in a way, he kind of stepped on his own message there, because at the time, his good friend Julian Assange at WikiLeaks was dribbling out day after day the emails related to Clinton's. Trump keeping his controversy alive overshadowed this story that would have paid to his attention. So, none of this is to suggest the press is perfect. In this campaign and every other, and in day-to-day life, it makes mistakes. I had a wonderful boss years ago at the Philadelphia Bulletin who liked to say, "Rem, journalism is a very inexact science," and that's true. But I think in this case, much of the negative coverage of Trump has been earned, and I mentioned some of those investigative stories that the Post has had. And I think he's very cynically using this as a tactic to, because he knows it'll play with his crowd. And some of those crowds get pretty angry at the reporters who are all penned up there. And Committee to Protect Journalists, it's usually worried about, you know, countries like Iran, has even warned about Trump's impact on the free press. That's astonishing.
Hmm. Let's dig into WikiLeaks a little bit, because instead of journalism, we have hackers who are really releasing private information, whereas it's not what a journalist would have done traditionally to hack into someone's email, but it sort of crosses into this gathering information, finding out what's behind the personalities and what's happening behind closed doors. Let's talk a little bit about WikiLeaks and how it plays into not only the Trump candidacy, but to the election and journalism in general.
Well, the evolution of WikiLeaks is has been fascinating. You'll remember a time when it was the darling of the left for mm-hmm. the secrets it was releasing. But somewhere along the line, Julian Assange seems to have undergone some kind of transformation. And he really seems this time to be trying to use his organization to defeat Hillary Clinton, who he just can't stand, and to elect Donald Trump. And there's this weird trifecta where you have the Trump campaign, you've got Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, and the Russians, because apparently this hacked material is coming from Russian hackers allied to the Russian government. So you have Russia trying to influence an American election, and its conduit is Mr. WikiLeaks holed up in the Ecuador embassy in London, and timing these releases to the benefit of the Trump campaign. I mean, this is something, if you read in a novel a couple of years ago, you wouldn't have believed it for a second. I mean, it used to be the Democrats who were supposed to be soft on Russia. Hmm. And now, you know, Russia's busy trying to...
How certain are we of that relationship? How certain are we of the intentions of WikiLeaks?
Assange has not been bashful about that. Mm-hmm. And he's been... There's a passage he wrote about Hillary Clinton on his... online that was astonishing, where he said that Hillary Clinton enjoys spilling human blood. I mean, he clearly has quite an animus against her. I don't know that it's any love for Donald Trump, but Donald Trump is the vehicle that he's got to beat her.
Let's talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton and her candidacy and her relationship with the media, which is not necessarily sunshine and roses either.
That's very true. I mean, it's hard to imagine that Hillary Clinton's one of your candidates, and she's the one who, of the two, who is the least dismissive and disdainful of the press. Mm. Hillary Clinton, as a result of the many years of scrutiny of her and of her husband, former President Bill Clinton, and there are many controversies, some real, some not, has come out of all that with a very jaundiced view of the press, doesn't like it at all, really likes to minimize contact, and for when, you know, month after month without having a press conference, mm-hmm. very press averse, didn't have anybody, she had a kind of pool, but not really a pool, so nobody was with her that on. No journalists were with her on 9/11 when she had that episode at the 9/11 event and had to be helped mm-hmm. away. And then later turned out she had pneumonia. But there were hours when nobody really knew what had happened to her. I mean, that's how press averse she is. And her, you know, we talked about Trump's camp complaints. The Clinton camp has been very upset with the media too, because they take the position that the emails and the Clinton Foundation. That these stories have been grossly overplayed by the press, that there's, you know, nothing here, please move on. which I think is kind of crazy. You can argue mm-hmm. that maybe individual stories were overcovered, but I think these are really substantial issues. I mean, there hasn't been a proven quid pro quo with the foundation, but certainly there was a lot of, you know, questionable contact and stuff that she should have... inoculated herself from. And I think, you know, the emails obviously are turned out to be a real story. I mean, having all that, it's just not, it's common sense that you don't have, as a Secretary of State, you don't have all this communication on an insecure server. But it's part of what, something I think that alienates people about the Clintons, that sense of entitlement that, you know, our intentions are great, our hearts are pure. Why are you questioning about this? And I think she really hurt herself with the initial response. And the initial response went on for months, where she was kind of minimizing it and making light of it even. And it took her a long time to kind of sort of apologize.
Mm-hmm. Not a story you want to move on from necessarily, even now, and with this weekend, new revelations of possible sort of new evidence, new emails from her aide. How does the press handle something like that, where they really don't have access to all the information? What they have is a whole lot of vagueness, and it's real close to the election. What's the media response during during these final days?
Well, the initial response to those that bombshell of FBI Director Comey and his letter to Congress and it kind of bringing the email issue back to the fore and new emails that they're looking at. The initial response of the press was not very good. They kind of fell for the Republican spin. And so some of those the early stories made it sound more explosive than it was. And those stories had to be walked back. But I think a lot of that blame, the press, again, was moving fast and falling for the spin. But I think Comey has a lot to account for with this. And you see it in the reaction of so many Republican prosecutors who have come out to criticize them that, this is this is against tradition and rules to do something this political so close to an election. And the letter itself, as you mentioned, was so vague, it was really impossible to figure out what it was saying. And it was just a very ham-handed thing to do. And again, I think what's telling is not so much the Clinton response to it as I heard Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney general under George W. Bush, who was kind of a patron of Comey's, being very critical of him for this action. And it certainly, in an election that's had no shortage of tumult, it certainly added some fresh tumult with a week and a half to go.
How do you not fall for spin? How do journalists not fall for spin when the news cycle moves so quickly? And it clearly is an important story. It's certainly not something that you could just overlook either.
Couldn't overlook it. You should have. It needed to be. It was news. It was big news, clearly. But it's an ancient tension in journalism between speed and accuracy, and it's been upped enormously during the digital age, when the pressure to be instantaneous is huge. But that's all the more reason to be really careful. I mean, you didn't need to fall for the spin. You could have stuck to look closer at just what the document said and write those stories more carefully. So I don't think, speed is an explanation, but it's not an excuse.
Are journalists being asked more and more to be personalities in that regard and to offer their opinion, offer their insight more quickly? It seems to me on certain channels there's a lot more back and forth where there's a round table and everybody's talking and they're not necessarily sticking to the facts. They're sticking to some of their thoughts. And sometimes even those conversations are lined up with, here are your Trump supporters, here are your Clinton supporters, let's go at it. Is it that line getting blurred?
The line is blurred, although I think that's not what was at stake here. I think this was just sloppy journalism. Hmm. But definitely there is pressure to be personality. If you're for example, CNN has a big digital political team, but they do a story and then they're on television, and that's fine if you're just talking about what the story said. But I think the more it's very difficult to be a reporter on Tuesday and a commentator on on Thursday. But if I can pick up on something you just said about the designated Trump supporters and the designated Clinton supporters, I think that's one of the most bankrupt practices I've seen in a long time. It's just ridiculous. It adds nothing to the conversation. I find it infuriating. Yeah. There are a lot of people who know a lot about politics. Get three or four of them out there who don't have an affiliation and let them talk about the issues. And there is some of that on television. There's some really smart people doing it. Yeah. But those, it's kind of a growth to, and kind of an exacerbation of the old problem. You remember the show Crossfire, which CNN had and went off the air mercilessly. And then they foolishly brought it back and it didn't last very long. But that's another really bankrupt practice. Let's get somebody who believes A. Let's get somebody who believes B. They weren't necessarily like campaign surrogates, but it's the same thing. And just let's mud wrestle. And that sheds absolutely no light. And it's a waste of time. And you remember a wonderful Jon Stewart moment when he went on the show on Crossfire and told him that they were ruining democracy. I mean, it was just a seminal moment where he basically went into the belly of the beast and called it out for what it is.
Right.
And I was so I wrote a column fulminating about the return of Crossfire, and I was delighted it lasted about 20 seconds. But this is in real escalation. You know, this the designated Trump person, that's got to end.
When we come back, the role of comedians like John Oliver and Stephen Colbert in a presidential election, plus a look back at Watergate. More with Rem Ryder after the break. You're listening to Midday SDPB Radio. Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. We continue our conversation now with former USA Today media columnist Rem Ryder. How about these comedians? I remember seeing John Oliver from HBO on a new show, and he said, I'm not a journalist, and people are confusing me as a journalist. I'm a satirist. I'm a comedian. However, they're influencing, Stephen Colbert and John Oliver are influencing the conversation in this country in a way.
Very much so. I mean, I remember Stewart would always insist, I'm not a journalist, but he played it's true. He's a comedian, not a journalist. But he played, and John Oliver, brilliantly, I would say, is now doing the same, playing a big journalistic role. Hmm. Because what they're doing is bringing insight to important stories and doing it in a clever and also often brutal way that really hammers home the point. It's not the BBC or page one of Le Monde, but it's often making deeper political points. And Saturday Night Live does the same thing. I mean, the SNL debate, cold opens have become essential viewing. But so you're absolutely right. I think, yes, John Oliver is not a journalist, but he plays an important role in the political conversation. And, I mean, a political conversation shouldn't just be one thing. The only thing out there shouldn't be the BBC and page one of Le Monde. I mean, the mix ought to have, there's room for objective reporting and investigative reporting, but the commentary, not the meaningless Trump supporter versus Hillary supporter, but actual smart commentary is really valuable, even the traditional punditry. But somehow in new ways and bold ways, the John Olivers of the world can really, really make important points.
Do they fill a vacuum?
Yeah, probably. That's a good way to put it. I mean, because they have a freedom there that enables them, to push the envelope and sometimes push the envelope, into three states away, but at the despair being one of those states. Yeah, I think, it's kind of a new form of political commentary. Yeah. And I think Stewart deserves a lot of question for pioneering. John Oliver has just been amazing. I mean, he makes John Stewart seem like PBS.
What stories are not getting told when you have those, Trump supporter, Clinton supporter, just mud wrestling, as you mentioned? Now, what are we overlooking right now as you watch the coverage going into November 8th? Are there plain old stories that we're missing out on and we should be paying a whole lot more attention than we are?
Well, I think this is a tough one to figure out how to circumvent it. But because, I wrote a column a while ago basically saying Trump, through the sheer force of Trumpness, had really turned this into the reality TV campaign through the nature of his controversies and the way he approaches things. So there's been an enormous shortage of coverage of traditional issue coverage. There hasn't been a lot of issue coverage of this campaign. And partly it's due to the fact that the way Trump is and what he, the things he stirs up, and Clinton, of course, has brought some of her own baggage as well. But we've ended up, it's really been kind of a low calorie campaign coverage diet. There's also been the need to really vet Trump because Trump Hillary's been around for seemingly forever. But, there was the need to do these deep dives into Trump's business practices and all the rest of it. But I think and also let me say this, issue coverage is important, But people really do, when they choose presidents, a lot of it is presidential personality, presidential character. And so I think all that is important and fair game. But it's just amazing how little focus is there has been on issues.
What do you wish that we knew? What's the story that you wish you could open up the Post or the Times or USA Today and read that would illuminate something that the American public needs to know before voting next week?
I don't have a smart answer to that question.
Do we know everything? All the laundry has been aired, other than what's going to get rolled out is the next October surprise, in quotation marks.
this is one election where I would never say we know everything.
Right.
Because it's, and I think a mistake that the media often make is to decide things are over. I mean, we saw, it's hard to remember that time before Comey's statement. But as recently as last week, I mean, the consensus, the narrative, media narrative was that Clinton's lead was growing and Trump was toast. Mm-hmm. And that was like 5 days ago. And what happens is we read so much into the polls and we're obsessed with polls. It's important to remember that polls aren't predictions. Polls are a reflection, they're a snapshot of public opinion at that moment. And campaigns are not stagnant. They're fluid, and things, i.e. James Comey's bombshell, happen. So I think, I mean, that's an important thing to keep in mind that we never do and never will, but that decide, you know, the game doesn't end in the seventh inning. Mm. And think about it. If as a result of all this turbulence, Trump wins this election, there are going to be a lot of journalists who the dead crows will have vanished because they all have been eaten.
Let's go down ballot a little bit and dig deeper into what you just said and talk about a state like South Dakota, where we have a senator like John Thune, a representative like Kristi Noem, very powerful candidates in this state. How do you approach a contender in a largely Republican state? How much coverage? When do you call it and say, hey, this is not a legitimate challenge to someone like John Thune? And when is that doing a disservice to everyone?
I think you call it like when the votes are counted. Hmm. I mean, part of the it's very important in a local or a state election, pretty than a local election when you might just have a handful of outlets covering something. But in a state election too, even though you're not going to bet heavily that John Thune is going to lose, you got to cover it like it's an election. It is an election, and voters get to go to the polls, and so you should cover it as if it were a contested election. I think we're so into the horse race and we're so concerned with who wins and who loses that you can lose sight of the fact that the major reason for covering these things is to give voters information so they can make intelligent decisions. Mm-hmm. And even though it might not be as sexy, it's important to remember that John Thune, yes, is not running on, or whoever else, not running unopposed. And, you know, what are their positions on X and you know, what's his record been and all of that kind of thing. I mean, that's there'll be plenty of time to, pick winners and losers after the voters do it, because it's kind of their job.
Is there an area of journalism that really, that new journalists, students who are studying now, people who are just entering the industry, that they can really step into that you'd like to see get developed in the future?
It's people, always ask, why would anybody go into journalism today? Because you read so much about the travails of traditional journalism. And yet, in many ways, it's such an exciting time to go into journalism because the digital age has brought us so many new forms and new players and new, fabulous new ways of telling stories. What stays the same is the importance of journalism values, of truth-telling, of fairness, of doing aggressive investigative reporting. And so I think for journalism students, the opportunities, they need to be flexible. They can't, it's not like, the olden days where you say, I am determined to work for a newspaper or that kind of thing. You've got to be wide open to, and besides, none of the journalism students probably have heard of newspapers, so that's not really an issue. But you got to be very flexible in the form. But what you're not flexible about is is the actual work. Those verities are still what matter to doing public service journalism. And there's very exciting opportunities to do that. We've seen the rise of ProPublica, a national investigative reporting digital operation. And that's a good example of, the fact that, new things happen. BuzzFeed, which you think of for all its viral genius, has developed a investigative reporting unit and has done really good campaign reporting. In fact, one of its campaign teams was stolen a few weeks ago by CNN. You've had Politico grow out of from nowhere to be a force. And at the local level, there's some really good locally focused websites. I mean, so it's a very exciting time to be to go into journalism. It's just fasten your seatbelt.
Yeah. Does the local newspaper go away? We just saw cuts here last week. Lost our publisher, regional publisher now. No one in Sioux Falls. Does the newspaper eventually fold and you get your news only on your devices?
The answer is probably yes. When that is, though, I don't know. It seems to me I've been reading the obituary of the print newspaper for 20 years, and they seem to have gone way past their enjoy-by date. But there's no question that, so many people access news digitally. I mean, I find it myself. I spent a lot of so much of my life in print journalism, but I spent an awful lot of time reading on a phone. I realized my life had changed irrevocably when I read a profile of Yahoo's Marissa Mayer, and I later on the phone, and later realized I had read a 22,000 word profile on a tiny phone screen.
The smallest screen possible.
A buddy of mine at USA Today told me that was a desperate cry for help, which it may be. The other thing, more worrisome thing, though, is that print advertising is declining more rapidly at a time when people, kind of hoped it was a level off at some point, but it's at an alarming rate. So, the prognosis, first of all, as the old lyric goes, nothing lasts forever, even though we always think it will. But that's a worrisome trend line. At the same time, many newspapers continue to make money, and it just seems like we've been consigning them. We've been burying them for years. The trend lines all suggest they're going to go away at some point. When that is, you need a better soothsayer than I am, which shouldn't be hard to find.
Looking back on decades in the industry, what are some of the highlights that you'll never forget?
My own personal?
This is my first, as a journalist, first presidential race that I have covered. And I'm quite sure 20 years from now, I will never forget that my first presidential race that I really paid attention to and had conversations about was Trump-Clinton.
Right.
So I'm thinking there's got to be some of those highlights for you in your career.
You've set the bar for yourself pretty high. Well, one of the things, that has always stood out in my mind is, even though, as my daughter says, I think I'm 27, so this sounds impossible, I covered Watergate.
Oh.
Which was, I didn't cover Watergate like Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein covered Watergate, but I was in the Washington Bureau of a now defunct paper that once had a circulation of 800,000 called the Philadelphia Bulletin,
really?
An evening paper, and so that was incredible. I mean, I had a regular seat at the Watergate hearings, and I'll never forget the moment when the disclosure that Richard Nixon had a taping system that was taping everything, and so a lot of these conversations would be available. I'll never forget that moment. So
how did you even process that at the time? Could you at the time really say this changes everything? What we've just been through has changed everything. Did you know that?
You look through the filter of history so often. I like to think I did. I mean, I just remember it was like a collective gasp, but like, where did that come from?
Right.
The other thing that I really, there were a lot of individual stories, but one of the, I loved the years of putting out a journalism magazine. I fell in love with magazines. I barely read a magazine when I got that job, and kind of the putting the words and the images together. But a real high point has been that, I was going to USA Today and jumping into a digital first newsroom and playing in an era so different than, you know, the other eras I had seen. And you know, as a media columnist, you know, responding, you know, I had two regular columns a week. I kind of assigned myself, but I would just, if something happened, I'd jump on it. And so, like, with each of the debates, you know, they'd end at 10:30 or whatever, and by 11, I'd be filing a column. And, you know, to get to played in that era, you know, this era was a highlight. And I'm, you know, very much looking forward to the next adventure, with a digital emphasis.
What is the next adventure for you? As of this week.
The college basketball season, Philly hoops. No, I'm talking to people about a couple of things, but nothing to announce yet.
We will be watching closely.
As Donald Trump was hailed, keeping you in suspense.
Rem Ryder, thank you so much for stopping by Dakota Midday. We appreciate your time.
This was so much fun. Thank you.
Thanks.